Welcome to the podcast today. I've got a guest today. I am so excited about Dr. Lee Warren, and I'm going to give you the introduction in just a minute, but I want to have you think like this. Have you ever caught yourself in a thought you knew that just wasn't helping you, but you couldn't stop it, or you reacted to something in a way that just surprised you, and afterwards you thought, why did I do that again? Or perhaps you held on to a belief that you knew probably wasn't true, but you just believed it anyway. Here's what I've come to understand. Most of us don't have a knowledge problem. We have a thinking problem. And those patterns, those mental grooves, those neural pathways or brain ruts don't just shape how we feel. They shape how we lead, how we communicate, how we make decisions, and ultimately, how we show up in the world. Now, today's conversation is about one of the most liberating ideas I've encountered, that you're not stuck with your thinking, that you can actually change the way your brain works. And that doing that might be the most important leadership work you ever do. Now, the hardest part, most leaders think leadership is about helping others, but if you actually lead a team, you know what the hardest part is. It's leading yourself. Your thoughts, your reactions, your assumptions, the beliefs that you never stop to question. And here's where it gets a little bit complicated. When you're managing your own thinking, you're dealing with the thinking of everyone you lead. Different beliefs, different fears, different interpretations of the same reality. And here's what I know to be true, and is that people don't really change their mind because they're presented with a bunch of facts. They're going to hold on to their beliefs even when reality is staring them in the face. So if we can't examine our thinking, how can we lead others to change theirs? Now, there's a concept called brain ruts, and we're going to talk a little bit about this, but that concept, brain ruts, is a neural pathway. And these neural pathways are patterns of thinking that reinforce and are repeated over years. And these beliefs are formed sometimes when we're 8 or 10 years old, and we're trying to make sense of a world we don't fully understand. But those thoughts get repeated, reinforced over and over, until they stop feeling like thoughts. They just feel like truth. But here's the problem. Some of those beliefs aren't true. And they're deeply wired into our brain. And even though new information arrives, we cannot stop thinking about it. So this isn't theoretical for me. It's not abstract. It's, you know, when I had to face my own thinking through loss, through addiction, through beliefs that were completely false but felt real, and I had to firsthand get to understand what the costs of those beliefs when you can't break free. So I thought, we're talking about the brain, we're talking about the mind, we're talking about neural pathways. What a better guest to have than a brain surgeon. So Dr. Lee Warren is a brain surgeon, and I'm so excited he gets to be on today. So he understands the human brain at a level that most of us never will. And as a neurosurgeon, he literally has held lives in his hands. I think it's fascinating that in Iraq, he performed over 200 brain surgeries in just 125 days. But what makes Dr. Lee Warren's perspective extraordinarily is just not the clinical knowledge. It's that he had to live through the kind of losses that would break most people. He returned from Iraq with PTSD, a marriage that was struggling. And then on August 20th, 2013, he had to deal with one of the most challenging things any parent would ever have to deal with, abruptly losing a child. Most people facing losses like that would go quiet, but Dr. Warren went deeper into neuroscience, into his faith, and into the hardest work of his life, examining and rebuilding his own thinking. That journey produced this book called The Life-Changing Art of Self-Brain Surgery, and I highly recommend you pick up this book. This is resonating with people across the country because it answers the questions we all carry. Can I change the way I think? And his answer is absolutely. You can, and he's going to show you how. Dr. Warren, I am so excited and so looking forward to our conversation. Thank you for being here.
Jim, it's an honor to be with you, my friend. Thank you.
Well, let's start the conversation. You know, you've operated on hundreds of brains, and you've actually seen what the brain looks like on the inside. But in your work, you draw a distinction between the brain and the mind. And most people treat those as the same thing. Are they?
They are not. It's becoming more and more clear that they're not, as 21st century neuroscience has shown us now with specialized imaging. But if you're right, that historically, really for the last 300 years or so in the West especially, we've believed that our brains generated everything that we think to be true of our lives. Every thought you have, every feeling, every belief, every action, every possibility, potential, talent, all those things come from your brain in the traditional training. And in fact, most traditional neuroscientists and neuropsychiatrists and psychologists have believed that our brains actually generate even the perception that we have our own thoughts and feelings and will and those kinds of things, choices, but that all of it is just an artifact of the way our neurons fire. And so that's kind of the traditional background thinking. But all along, there's been a lot of people from faith, from philosophy, from psychology, from other disciplines that were like, wait a minute, no, that we do have an internal life. We understand that my perception of what the color blue means to me is different than what it means to you. We think about what we think about, and we have an interior life that's not the same as our brain. And then the 21st century came along, and we started being able to do what we call functional brain imaging, where you can put somebody in a scanner now, and you can examine, not just take a picture of what the brain looks like, but what the brain's actually doing when someone's thinking. And I had an experience like that after we lost our son that I'm sure we'll get into, but you can actually ask somebody to think about something, and then you can see their brain change in response to what they're thinking about, and then watch their body change in response to what their brain's doing. And so it's very clear now that regardless of whether this is a brain-generated process, which I don't believe, or whether they're actually two distinct entities, mind and brain are not the same thing. Functionally, I don't think they're the same thing structurally either. But definitely, if you learn to discern that your thoughts change how your brain works, you begin to get on top of this conundrum that you described in your opening.
Yeah, I think that's very insightful. One of the questions I wanted to ask you about, you know, that kind of prompted the thought is, when you're watching somebody and you're asking them to think about something happy or something sad or something anxious or a fear, you can see actually what is happening in the brain with some of these scanners, but there's also chemical processes that are going on. So there's neuropeptides, there's neurotransmitters, there's a lot of things, you know, where people know about cortisol, they know about adrenaline, norepinephrine, serotonin, oxytocin, dopamine.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how when you think those thoughts or you're controlling, your mind is telling your brain, it's bringing out chemicals. And can you kind of explain that a little bit better?
Yeah. So there's always this thing that's happening when something is happening. And so if we get into this thing where we think our thoughts are just psychological entities, but you're right. When you think something different than you were previously thinking and your brain changes which areas are being lit up, and then your body changes physiologically and how it's responding to that, structural things are happening inside your brain. And those structural things are stuff like genes getting switched on and switched off and proteins getting transcribed and neurotransmitter levels getting up or down regulated. Like there's physical structural things changing in response to those thoughts and those brain responses that are happening. And so in terms of neurotransmitters, for example, like the entire balance of what the chemical environment of your brain is, unlike what we've been taught for generations that some people have imbalances or if you're depressed, you don't have enough serotonin or whatever, we know that those levels are dynamic and they're constantly changing in response to our thought life. And so, so it's not just some sort of morphological thing. It's actually a physical, structural, gene switching, protein transcribing thing that's happened. So you need to understand that your thoughts have incredible real world impact on what your brain is doing functionally and what it becomes structurally.
Yeah, it's just fascinating. I mean, I envy you in that you get to have all of this knowledge, and I'm just still scratching the surface on this stuff. It's very, very interesting to me. Now, one of the things you talk a little bit about in your book was something called brain ruts.
Yeah.
Or neuropathways. These are deeply reinforced patterns. And when that happens in the brain, what's actually going on psychologically?
And so there's two sort of principles I think we ought to lay out before we get deep into that. And one principle is that despite what we've been taught, if you can just set aside what you've always thought and believed about the brain and the way the brain works, the actual truth is that the brain is never the same from moment to moment throughout your whole life. Your genes gave you a certain brain structure at birth, your family of origin and your worldview that you were raised in and the things you've been through have changed the way your brain was shaped and the things your brain did. But from moment to moment, your brain structurally changes its connections between neurons and groups of neurons with physical connections called axons and dendrites and those junctions called synapses. Those things change dynamically every second of your entire life. So your brain is constantly remaking itself. That process that drives that remaking is called neuroplasticity. That's kind of a famous phrase everybody talks about now. And the way neuroplasticity works is that the more you focus on something and the more attention you pay to something and the more times you spend thinking about that thing, so the more repetition of attention and intention that you apply to that, the more of those connections that get made. So that's the two kind of principles, that the brain is never the same from thought to thought, and that the brain reinforces repeated thought and attention over time. That's the system that's operating underneath all this. And when I lived in Wyoming, there was a place in Wyoming close to Casper that you can go to today in 2026, and you can see the ruts in the ground that were made by the wagons on the Utah Trail and the Mormon Trail on as people migrated west. You can see those ruts in the ground that are still there today. And the reason they're still there is because they were so deeply worn that the ground was impacted underneath them and they became permanent, and they just don't go away because they're so worn, repeatedly have been passed by the same, the wagons passing by the same trail, right? So think of brain ruts in the way that you think about wagon tracks on the ground, that these are grooves if you want to think about them, but they're not really grooves because they're actually these dendrites and axons that are physical wires like the one on my microphone that I'm talking to you through that are reinforced and grown in number by the more times a particular thought or belief or action have been repeated. And so that means that your brain literally over time becomes extremely automated. The process the brain's trying to carry out is to automate behaviors that you repeatedly do so that you don't have to use mental energy or resources to carry those things out. This is the basis of what we call muscle memory, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have an athlete that shoots 10 million free throws, right, the first 100,000, you have to think about them. You get it down. And then before you know it, you're shooting free throws and you're making them and you're not even thinking about it. Before you know it, if you change to a new office tomorrow, you have to think about the drive from your house to the office. You have to pay every lane change, school crossing, every place where there's a speed trap or a red light, you're thinking about it, actively engaged in the process of driving. But after a few days, you get to the office and you were listening to a podcast or you were talking on the phone. You never even thought about the drive, right? You slowed up, you sped up and slowed down and stopped and started and changed lanes. You never even thought about it because your brain automated that to take that load off of your mind. So the process that's running underneath this is your brain doesn't care what it is that you're asking it to automate. Doesn't care if it's true, doesn't care if it's false, doesn't care if the belief helps you or hurts you. If you repeatedly focus on it, pay attention to it, and intend to automate it, you will automate it over time. And that becomes the more you have applied that process of attention, intention, and repetition, the more wired that particular thing is. That the neuroanatomy principle is called Hebb's Law. They say neurons that fire together wire together. So if you think about it, like if you have a lamp on your desk, if you wanted to move that lamp to another place in your office, you would just unplug that wire and move it. But if that lamp, every time you turned it on, another wire appeared, and now there's two, and then you turn it on again, and now there's three, and then you turn it on again, and now there's four. And after you use it for 5 or 10 years, there's 1,000. If you want to move that lamp now, you've got to unplug all those wires and move it somewhere else and plug them all back in. That would be hard to do. That's why habits are so hard to break, because you have laid down hundreds of thousands or millions of wires to automate that particular belief. That's why things become part of what we believe we are over time. We accept them as not just neural pathways or neural ruts or brain ruts. We begin to think that they're identifying of us. This is how I am. I'm anxious. I'm scared. I'm a jerk. I'm an alcoholic. Whatever it is that we believe, we have reinforced, and those ruts become deeper and deeper and deeper, like the wagon trails in Wyoming, only because we have attended to them so often. And so that's what's going on structurally in your brain when you feel like something can't change, or you feel like something has become part of who you are. It's really just a bunch of stuff that you've laid down more wires to connect.
I like that. Now, let me give you a couple examples that are coming to mind. First of all is one that comes to mind that a lot of us have is a neural pathway or something that fires all the time. And we've reinforced, well, I'm horrible with names. I'm horrible with names. And so now I have this belief that I can't remember people's names. And so that always fires. So if I want to change that belief, I can't just change it. I need to replace it with something. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. The way this process works is the execution of one of those brain ruts. And it's not a great analogy in the sense that wagon ruts are there whether or not you're using them, right?
Okay.
So the wagon trails in Wyoming are there all the time, whether somebody's driving a wagon over them or not. But brain habits, these automated pathways, actually begin to wither over time when they're not reinforced and used over time. Mm-hmm. So that things that your brain is automated become less triggerable after years or sometimes months or weeks of disuse. So that's where things like addiction come into play. How do you stop drinking alcohol? It takes a long time of diverting that stimulus to a different response. And so when you say, how do you get your brain to have a different response to a trigger, you can't just say, I'm going to use willpower and I'm going to stop doing this thing or stop believing this thing, because the automation is still there for a long time, and even remnants of it will be there forever. But if you take that trigger, okay, when I think I'm bad at names, I'm instead of giving up because I've identified myself as that and now it's become an excuse for me not even trying, now I'm going to develop a system and I'm going to attempt to automate this new thing. Then when you get that stimulus, here's a name, I need to remember it. I have a process I'm trying to reinforce to create a new rut, and you begin to tell your brain to engage this new system. Then over time, that becomes, again, Hebb's law, neurons that fire together, wire together. You're driving a new response in association with that trigger. You will reinforce it and you will automate it over time. It might take a long time. That goes back to that analogy with the lamp that I said. If you have a long held belief that's been your thing, like my dad was lousy with names, my mom was lousy with names, I've never been. Nobody in my family can remember anybody's name, right? That's been automated and rewired in your brain, and there's hundreds of cables connecting that lamp to the outlet. And if you want to change it, you've got to sever a whole bunch of those synaptic connections, and you've got to rebuild a whole bunch of new ones in order for the new automation to take precedence over the old one.
Well, thanks, Jason. I really appreciate that. I'm kidding.
I love it. You teed that right up.
Yeah, I always kid with people, and I said, you know, I didn't do good at that Sam Carnegie memory class. And the people who've read Dale Carnegie get it immediately. The people who haven't, they miss it. So I can tell who's read it and not. Here's something I never fully understood. It's why people cling to beliefs that aren't true, even when you present with evidence right in front of them. Is that a brain problem, or is that like an identity problem?
Well, the answer to that is probably multifactorial, because it also could be a character problem. It could be a worldview problem, right? I mean, a lot of people would much rather be wrong and never admit it and defend it to the death than they would to be identified as having held a belief that turned out not to be true. Right? So that so that might be a character issue.
Okay.
On a more positive spin. I think it's that we begin, we don't, none of us really believe that what we believe is up for grabs. We think it's true. And we think our view of reality is more accurate than somebody else's is. And that's really what we see in the world. Everybody has a perception that I'm wise enough that what I see with my eyes and what I decide in my mind is going to be true. I'm smart enough to know that I'm not duped by the world. I'm not faked out by things.
Yep.
And so then when we begin to see something up, something else popping up that challenges that belief, then we have to say, wait a minute, have I been spending a whole bunch of years like chasing something that was never true? That's hard to accept, mm-hmm. especially if there's been some consequences in your life of holding that view.
Yeah.
That now you may have to say, wow, you know, wow, maybe that marriage didn't end because my wife was just a jerk. Maybe I had something to do with that. You know, maybe my company didn't fall apart because everybody else did the wrong thing. Maybe some of my decisions had something to do with that. Now it becomes ownership in the outcome, right? So I think once you start recognizing that people believe themselves to be perceptive of reality in a way that's sharper than other people, then it's hard to accept that maybe you're not, because then you start questioning, why was I so gullible to not think that this was real when it wasn't? And I think part of that is that we all need to understand that reality is not actually ever a fixed entity. Reality is a picture that your brain is painting for you as it tries to make sense of the world, right?
Yeah.
So, and the other thing is that we know that's very clear now and very 100% defensible from the neuroscience standpoint is that most of the time your brain doesn't actually show you, your eyes don't see what's actually out there. Your brain actually shows you what you have asked of it with your mind to show you. So that, in other words, what you're looking for is mostly what you see in the world around you. That there's a part of your brain called the reticular activating system. It's this bundle of neurons in your brainstem that, among other things, has to do with filtering what you're going to perceive based on what you're focusing on. And a good example of that is if you oversleep your alarm and you wake up and you're super grumpy because you're running late and you're, oh, no, now it's going to be a terrible day. Everything you see is going to reinforce that it's a bad day. Every interaction that you have is going to be perceived as the other person being a jerk, or you're going to get hosed, or you're going to get fired, because you're filtering. Your reticular activation system has heard the command, look out, because this is going to be a bad day. And now you're beginning to see that evidence that was there already, that it is going to be a bad day. And you're not going to see other evidence that maybe it doesn't have to be all that way. And so there's a famous psychological phenomenon called the Bader-Meinhof phenomenon, which is where, you know that. So like you see a yellow Ferrari on the street you've never noticed before, and you go, wow, there's a yellow Ferrari. Holy cow. And then the next day you see five of them. And the day after that you see 20 of them. And they were always there. You just weren't noticing them. And now your brain is activated to the presence of yellow Ferraris, and you see them all over the place. And then that works in the converse, too. There's this selection bias where if you're not looking for something, you don't see it oftentimes. There's a famous – you can Google that gorilla experiment on YouTube. Have you seen that? Like there's this famous psychological experiment where a team dressed in red and a team dressed in blue are passing basketballs around, and they ask the audience, okay, count how many times the red team passes the ball in this video, and they'll count. And then after the end, they say, well, how many times did the gorilla walk by? And they said, I didn't see a gorilla. And then they play the tape again, and there's this guy in a gorilla suit walking all around. But because you're looking for you're counting passes, you don't see it.
Yeah.
And so we think we're seeing reality, but we're really seeing what we're looking for. And so that filters into our beliefs, right? We believe something's true, and there might be all kinds of evidence around us that it's not all the truth or not true at all, but we don't see it because we're not looking for it.
Oh, I think that is so important. You know, advertisers have this down. When I started learning about the reticular activator, it was more in marketing and advertising. They said, you know, familiarity, you know, the yellow Ferrari, you see them all over. Danger is another one that will engage it. But the other thing is when something is a novelty or a nuance that you don't understand. So that's where the baby monkey puppy Mountain Dew commercial, everyone's looking at that and saying, there's something's not right. And then it takes you out of alpha mode into beta mode, or, you know, it kicks on that reticular activators. But that's really good. When somebody refuses to examine a belief, are they trying to protect the belief itself? Or are they trying to protect who they think they are? What do you think?
I think, again, it's context dependent, right? You talk about religious beliefs. You could talk about interpersonal beliefs. You talk about business ideas. You, depending on what you're discussing, that can have a lot of different answers. But I think we, especially in today's culture, we have so much focus on what we think is identity. We talk about identity as if it's a fixed thing. Mm-hmm. But identity really is the set of things that you've accepted to be true, whether or not they're actually true. And this is where we get into this really important thing that most people, I think, don't know. And that is that your brain does not care and actually cannot discern between something that's true or something that you're just thinking about or something that you just wish or want to be true or believe to be true. Furthermore, your brain doesn't discern between something that's really happening or something that you're just imagining or ruminating or worrying about. So the physiological response that your brain has to something you're scared of, for example, that you hear a sound and it's an axe murderer, you know, breaking through your window, that produces a fight or flight response and a cortisol release in your body and a whole bunch of physiological changes because there's a real threat. But if you're just lying in bed and you imagine an axe murderer breaking through your window and you begin to be afraid of it, the physiological response in your brain and your body is exactly the same as if that danger were really there. And so that means that most of us have these ideas about things that we think are true, and our body, our brain begins to model and rewire and create patterns and synapses and physiological responses as if that were really true. And then we feel like it's true because our body has changed in response to it. And then we reinforce that belief and it becomes who we think we are. And so then after a long time of investing heavily in a set of things that support that identity or that identifying belief, now we've got skin in the game. We've been public with it. We've thought about it. We've had relationships end over it or start over it. We've had businesses rise or fall in response to it. Now we have a personal stake in that. And to admit or acknowledge that maybe that thing wasn't correct all along, maybe it's just something I've reinforced because I had some perceived benefit to it at the time, then there's a lot of sort of character level things that have to be changed if we're going to acknowledge that that is not really the case anymore. And so I think it's multiple things, Jim.
Yeah, I think for me, you know, having a belief at early 22 years old, one of the things that I knew 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 was that I didn't have a drinking problem and I didn't have a drug problem. And I was convinced of that because I had all of these identity issues that's not me. That's not who I am.
Yeah.
Now my life was falling apart. I couldn't maintain a job, relationships, all of the external factors that go into the life of a practicing addict. And I couldn't see it. But then there was a shift. There was a break in that pattern. There was a little bit of a crack in that armor. And I started to change my beliefs, but I thought, you know, the challenge for me was you could not convince me, even if you brought up all of the evidence, because my identity was that is not me.
Right.
Now, I see this play out in leadership constantly. You know, leaders are operating from beliefs of that just are simply not true about themselves, about other people, about what's possible. And they never stop to question, you know. So a leader might think, hey, I'm a great communicator, and they're really not. Or they should see the world the way I should see it, as I see it, and not understanding that people see the world differently. How much do you think, you know, because we're kind of in a leadership crisis right now, how much of leadership failure do you think is actually a thinking failure?
I think almost everything backs up to thinking, to the outcome of thinking. In my book, I talk about what we call the 10 commandments of self-brain surgery. These are things that I put together from neuroscience over the years that I've been studying this mind-brain issue after we lost our son. And the 10th one is thoughts become things. Everything that's real in your life started with a thinking pattern. that, that created the behavior or the decisions that you made, the choices that you made that resulted in that thing being real in your life. The microphone we're talking to started with an idea in somebody's mind, a thought, right? The guitar on the wall behind you and all of your relationships and everything about how you lead and how people respond to your leadership starts with the way that you think about that process, who you are, the things you say, the things you do, the goals you set for people, the beliefs that you have for people. Again, if you're wondering why you're not getting performance out of people, maybe you're looking for things that aren't there and you're holding them to standards that are impossible, or you're not looking for things that they're showing you that could really be helpful to your organization because you can't see those things because you're not filtering for them, right? So I think essentially all of it starts with the things that we think about. And as far as the results that we get, it has probably more to do with us and the way that we're interacting with our teams and the way that we're thinking about our teams than it does with the team themselves most of the time.
Oh, that is spot on. That is really good. And as somebody who's probably owned their own practice and had many people that they've had to lead, you know, you probably know this pretty well. Let's get into self brain surgery.
Yeah.
It's the central concept of what I wanted to talk about at this podcast, you know, so everything else was a setup to self brain surgery. What does it actually mean in practice, not just as a metaphor, but as a method?
Let me take you back to the day my son died.
Okay.
To get to it. And this is where it came from in my life. So Mitch died, my son, 19-year-old son, was stabbed to death, as you mentioned. And my wife, Lisa, ran our practice at the time. I was a solo practice neurosurgeon. We had 10 employees. Mm-hmm. We lived in Auburn, Alabama. And our office was on the university campus at Auburn University on the third floor of a building that on the first floor, they did this world-class functional MRI research that we talked about earlier. One of only three places in the country at the time that could do this type of imaging. And so Mitch died. And of course, if anybody listening has lost a child or a spouse, you know what grief is like, and you're mad and you're angry at God if you believe in God, and you're frustrated, and a lot of the things that you thought were true about your life are not true now. Like your kid's going to bury you someday. No, that's not true now. And so you're frustrated, you're overwhelmed, you're stressed. We were awash with all the neurotransmitter things that are happening in your brain and acute grief. And then reality hit about a month after Mitch died because our company was running out of money. I had 10 employees that needed to get paid, and I had an office to pay rent for. And my accountant said, hey, you guys got to go back to work, or you need to close your office for a while, let some people go. You're going to miss payroll if you don't get back to work. And so we had to go back to work. And so we did. And in the first week that we went back to work, there was a meeting that had been on our schedule where we were invited to go down and watch some of this functional MRI research. And so didn't feel like it, but I'm a nice guy. And if I say I'll be somewhere, I show up. And so my wife and I went down, and we were in the control room of this fancy multi-million-dollar functional MRI scanner. And they had this woman in there with headphones on, the patient that they were doing the research on. And they said, Mrs. Johnson, think about the worst moment of your life. Think about the hardest thing you've ever encountered. In my mind, I was there. I know exactly what that was for me. And so you saw this woman. They'd done a calibration scan so you could see what parts of her brain were active at baseline, were just kind of smoldering along metabolically. And functional imaging basically shows you what parts of the brain are getting blood flow at a particular time. And that's a proxy for what parts of the brain are metabolically active. So the more blood flow, the more the brain's doing in that area. So you could sort of see what she was doing when she wasn't thinking about anything in particular. And they said, think about this worst day of your life. And the fear center, the amygdala, lit up pretty quickly in response to whatever it was that she thought. She thought about something and her brain did something different than it had been doing before. And then shortly after the amygdala lit up, her heart rate went up and her blood pressure went up and her respiratory rate went up. Her vital signs changed. So that means that I saw with my eyes, and again, I'm a trained practicing neurosurgeon, so I'm raised up in this traditional neuroscience worldview that brain creates what we think of as mind and that everything about you is a result of a brain state, right? And so here I'm looking at this woman and I see what her brain state is, and they tell her to think something different than she was thinking. And I see her brain state change in response to that. With my eyes, I see this happen. And then I see her body change. And then they said, okay, time out. Now stop thinking about that, Mrs. Johnson, and start thinking about the best day of your life, the happiest memory you can muster. And again, she sort of furled up her brow and you saw her thinking. And then her amygdala calmed down, her frontal lobes came online, the insular cortex and the cingulate gyrus, different parts of her brain that are involved in emotional processing of happier things and executive control and all that. And then her physiology changed in response to that. Her blood pressure came down, her heart rate came down, her respiratory rate came down. And we saw again this sequence. I saw it with my eyes. Mind changing brain, which is changing body. And I had this moment of insight. I think it's, I'm a spiritual guy, but I think it's spiritual, where I had this insight that when you change what you're thinking about, you're making structural changes in your brain for the purpose of changing your life in some way. So, because again, we talked about it earlier, like when you change your thoughts, it's not some mystical metaphysical thing that's happening. It's a structural thing. Your brain is turning genes on and off, and your brain is producing neurotransmitters in different proportions than it was before. And then your body is physiologically reacting, which means that hormones are activating glands. It means that blood vessels are constricting or relaxing. Like, stuff is happening that's real. It's not metaphorical. It's actual physical things that are happening in response to the brain changing, in response to the mind changing what it was doing. And so I saw this sequence of mind to brain to body, and I realized that when I perform actual brain surgery on people, on my patients, what I'm doing is I'm intentionally making a structural change in their brain for the purpose of improving their life in some way. And so it just hit me that this is the same thing. Like, it's literally, you can choose to perform surgery on your own brain when you decide to think about one thing and not another thing. It's not a metaphor. It's not some sort of self-help gimmick or little phrase that you can, you know, little Zig Ziglar type thing you can put in your pocket and pull out when you want a handy slogan. It's like You're literally in possession of a process that drives the way your brain forms itself structurally and the way it performs its functions anatomically and physiologically, and that changes your body. And so that means, I realized in that moment, I've spent a month now grieving my son in a particular way, and thinking about my future in a way that says it's dark, it's hopeless, it can't be better. 80% of marriages fall apart after they lose a child. I'm thinking all these thoughts all day long. And I saw in my mind in that moment, Jim, that I've been writing programs that my brain's going to start executing that are going to start filtering for these things to become true in my life. And if I want my future to look different than that, I'm going to have to think about this event of losing my son in a different way than I have been thinking about it. Because if I want my brain to do something other than this hopeless spiral of grief and doom and pain and forecasting catastrophe into the future, I've got to think about this differently, because that's the mechanism I'm seeing of how you change your brain and how you change your body. And so I came up with this term self-brain surgery just because it described exactly what is happening in your brain when you choose to direct your thoughts from one way to another way. And that's when I started studying it. Like, hey, wait a minute, maybe I didn't have it right. Maybe brain and mind are not the same thing. Maybe my training didn't exactly equip me to think about this in the proper way. And so for the last 13 years, I've been writing and speaking and writing books and podcasting and trying to basically explain how it is that we can go through something and something hard and have it not put us in the ditch or not wreck our marriage or not destroy our business. And how is it that we can change the way we think about something that we've been thinking about for a long time in a particular way? And this led me to some surprising things. You know, how do people change their patterns of behavior that have been true for their family? How do we change these generational issues of my dad was an alcoholic, his dad was an alcoholic, his dad was an alcoholic, everybody in my family hits their kids when they're mad? All these things, I hear people say it all the time. I'm really attuned to it now. This is just how things are in my family. This is just how things are in our company. This is what we do. And even when they have bad outcomes, they continue to reinforce those identifying beliefs and those patterns of behavior that we discussed earlier, even when the outcomes are not helping them. And I just see it as clear as I'm seeing you on this screen right now, that it doesn't have to be that way, because you can change what your brain does as soon as you're willing to change what you think about all the time.
That is a powerful, powerful story. I've read it in a couple of your books, but having you articulate it again, it really has an impact on me as far as thinking about those situations. If somebody is sitting with that right now and they're recognizing that pattern, and they know it's not really working, where do they start? What's the actual first move you would recommend?
So just remember the basic principles that we laid out earlier, that your brain, it's not some big mysterious process that's happening. It's actually your brain is constantly seeking to automate things that you repeatedly think about or repeatedly do so that you don't have to think about them as much and you don't have to spend as much energy to pull them off. So that's what your brain is doing all the time.
Okay.
The process of neuroplasticity, neurons that wire together, the neurons that fire together, wire together, is always running. And you don't have to do anything special to get that to run the way it runs because that's how your brain is designed, okay? So if you have something in your life that is not helping you, a pattern in your marriage, a pattern in your business, a pattern in your finances, a pattern in your addictions, a pattern in the things that you choose to do when you're feeling bad, drink or do something to take your mind off of it. If it's not serving you well, the way to begin to attack it is to think about that lamp we talked about earlier. Mm. If I've been doing this for 100 years, there's 1,000 cables that I got to unplug and it seems overwhelming. But my dad used to say, if you want to eat an elephant, you do it one bite at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to make one thought decision today and I'm going to focus on it. And I'm going to think this thought. Every time I feel this thing that I used to think about in a particular way, now I want to think about it differently. You know what? My business doesn't have to be this way. My family doesn't have to be this way. I'm going to think about it in a different way. And you can engage whatever other things you need. You can engage faith or philosophy or any other sort of thing you can help to drive those thoughts when you replace a harmful thought with a better one. But whatever it is that you choose to put in place of the old one, choose something that's true, that you don't have cognitive dissonance about, that you don't have to sort of force yourself to believe some fairy tale that you're trying to make up, because you're choosing something that's actually true or achievable, right? Mm-hmm. So not, I can overcome this thing that's been bothering me for 40 years tonight. That might not be true, and you won't believe it if you try to pull that off by yourself. Or maybe I don't need help to get off the heroin or whatever it is, mm-hmm. right? You already know that you need help. And that's where I think the role of professionals, people always ask me, are you saying nobody needs a therapist? Are you saying nobody needs a pastor? Nobody needs a psychiatrist? No, I'm not saying that. But if you think about it from the perspective of me being a doctor, right? If I'm going to take my patient to surgery and I'm doing the pre-op stuff, I'm getting them ready to go, and I notice the EKG is showing that it looks like they might be having a heart attack, right? Mm. I'm a neurosurgeon, but I am not a cardiologist. Like, it's been a long time since I had to take care of anybody's heart. So do I buck up in pride and say, I know how to take care of this, and I just take my patient off to surgery and do the thing by myself, and then they have a heart attack while I'm operating on them and they die? Is that helpful to my patient? No. I call a cardiologist. I call an expert, and I say, hey, I've got this patient that I need to take care of, but there's something going on with them that I'm not an expert at. Can you come help me out? And they come along, and they don't walk in the room and say, hey, you're such a moron. You don't know how to do this. You know, why'd mm-hmm. you have to call me, loser? They don't say that. They say, hey, thanks for getting me involved. Let's get this guy better so you can operate on him, right? They join me as a colleague, and they help me deliver the care that my patient needs with compassion and skill. And that means that I'm a good doctor. It means that I've made a wise choice to engage the help that I need. But I haven't rescinded my – I haven't abdicated my responsibility to my patient, and I haven't stopped being their doctor. I haven't walked away, right? I'm more engaged, and my patient is more appreciative, and the outcome is better because I've chosen to get the help that my patient needed. So if you think about yourself as a – I'm calling you a self-brain surgeon, but in that model, you're also the patient, right? You're both. Yeah. You're the doctor and the patient. And so when your patient needs a consultant that has expertise that you don't have, that's when you call the therapist. That's when you call the psychiatrist or the pastor or the friend or whoever it is that you need to engage with some skill and expertise that you don't have so that you can compassionately and wisely deliver the care to your patient.
That is so good. That is a brilliant analogy. It's almost like I'm talking to a brain surgeon. Here is the hard question. If it is genuinely possible, if people can rewire their thinking, and a lot of us know that, why don't more people actually do it? I mean, what's stopping them?
A number of things. The first one is the vast majority of people, including politicians and business leaders and professional athletes and billionaires, the vast majority of people do not realize that they have any agency or choice in this matter. Like most people believe that it's who they are, how they're wired, that their brains are what they are. And in fact, since 1953, when Watson and Crick figured out about DNA, the prevailing dogma in our education, especially in the West, has been what we call genetic determinism, right? There's a gene for everything, and the genes you inherit turn you into who you are, and there's not a whole lot you can do about it. We've all been taught your brain's formed up by about 2.5, 3 years old. You can't really change it. Like, you're kind of stuck with the brain you have. We've all been taught that. Those are deeply held beliefs in our culture and our educational system. And so when somebody comes along and says, wait a minute, the neuroscientists have known since 1999 that your brain isn't the same from thought to thought. We've known that that's true. We've known that your brain actually does make new neurons and new connections between them for at least the last 25 years. And so it's taken a long time for this idea to catch on. But most people never hear that, and most people never think about it. And so since we know that the process of how your brain turns into what it is relates to the things you keep thinking about in the same way, that means most people just don't ever think about it. And so they keep getting what they've been getting out of the brain based on what they've been thinking about. That's the sort of corollary to my ninth commandment, which is the more you do something, the better you get at it neurologically. That the punchline of that, or the flip side of that, is that whatever I want to become, the more I think about it down that path, I'm going to become more of that thing. Or the more I think about who I am from the same perspective, the more I will stay that person. So that means if you're not actively driving the thing, you're going to keep recreating the same person that you've always been, and it'll become a self-fulfilling prophecy. So that's the first group. The vast majority of people don't change because they don't ever think about the fact that they can. Mm-hmm. The social scientists talk about this word hope. This word, my favorite word, is hope. And they define hope as the belief that you can get there from here. Like, if the place you want to be is different than where you are, then the gap is the belief that you can cross the gap is defined as hope. And then they define the process of hope as being made up of two things, agency and opportunity. So agency is this ability that you believe you have to do something about a change that you want to make, right? You can do something about it. An opportunity is that there's a chance for you to do that thing. So if you have a possibility of changing something that you want to change and an opportunity to do that, then you can have hope. And if you have hope, that means you can believe that you can get there from here. So most of us don't actually believe that we can be something different than we have been because we believe it's our genes, it's our family, it's our parents, it's our mistakes, it's our past, it's whatever. And another thing that happens, and this is important for leaders, there's a thing called locus of control, right? Okay. So if you have an external locus of control, which means that you believe that things outside of you are the most important things in determining what you can be or how you can change. My wife's got to quit busting my chops. My kids have to make better grades. My boss needs to give me a raise, or I can't be happy, right? If you think that something outside of you determines your ability to be happy or grow or change or succeed, then you'll never be okay. Because as soon as those people do the things that you think you needed, you'll need something different to feel it the next time, because that gets into the dopamine reward system, right? When we achieve a reward that we didn't have to work for because somebody else did it for us, or somebody else gave it to us, or some substance triggered it, then we don't have the internal architecture to create that without that external stimulus, right? And so that means that we can't reproduce the thing that we thought was going to make us happy because, again, it happened outside of us. But if you can shift your locus of control to inside, to where you define what it is that needs to change, the habits, the performance changes, the thought issues that need to change in order for you to be happier, to define what happiness really is for you, then you can begin to be a real hopeful person, because you're actually able to do that agency and opportunity thing for yourself and not looking for it to happen outside of you. So I think the reason most people don't change, either they never thought about it or they have an external locus of control and they're waiting on somebody else to do something so they can finally be what they thought they should be.
Yeah, that's really good. In recovery, if you're a victim, then you have no agency. And so that the mindset is, I always tell sponsees, I wasn't a victim, I was volunteer. And yeah, that gives me,
that's right,
that gives me agency. I think that other part of it is we're always looking for a quick fix. And I can't teach you how to be a great guitarist at a weekend seminar.
That's
if
right.
I knew about that, if that was possible, everyone would be a great guitarist. It just takes time to play and practice. And you know this because you're a great guitarist. So let's talk a little bit about trauma. You've walked through losses most people can't imagine, in Iraq, loss of a marriage, loss of a son. You talk to other people who are going through, having difficult conversations with people about, brain cancer that they're going to have. How did those experiences challenge your own thinking, not as a neurosurgeon, just as a human being?
Yeah, I think that the most surprising thing that I learned is that it turns out that it's not ever the thing that we go through that turns out to be the most important thing in what we become or what the future looks like for us. It's not the thing, it's not the actual event. And the reason you know that is because two people can have similar circumstances and go through similar or identical events. And one of them will be okay. They'll be okay. They make it through. They remain hopeful. Another one will be destroyed by it. But the same event. We saw that at post-World War II in the Blitz. The people in England were just bombed every night, homes blown up. People just every day they would wake up and go out on the street and have to start rebuilding again. And after the war, like less than 50% of those people exhibited any signs of chronic trauma, like less than half of them. And it's because most of them just said, oh, we went through this together. I guess we better work together to rebuild our community and let's go fight the war. And they just got after it and got busy. Not everybody that went through that experience developed PTSD or long-term trauma responses. And so in my personal experience as a practicing neurosurgeon and as a victim, if you will, somebody who's been through all these things, I realized that I know lots of bereaved parents who 20 years later, you bump into them on the street and they're like still just right there in the moment of that complex grief. They're still right in the first thing they're going to say if you ask them how they're doing is that, I was just thinking about my son today and I'm having a rough day and his birthday's coming up. It's just right there on the tip of their emotional palate all the time. And then another person started a foundation and turn that loss into a legacy that they've helped thousands of people or save lives or help people get off addictions or whatever. They've turned it into something that gave them purpose, like Viktor Frankl talked about. And it turns out that it's the response that you adopt to what you go through, the set of things that you think about, the perspective from which you think about them, the choices you make in response to them. That's what trauma is. Trauma is the response to the event that you went through. It's not the event itself. And that's really good news, because if it was the event, then I'd be bereaved and hopeless because my son really is dead. He's gone. And I hope I get to see him again in heaven someday. But for now, like, he's gone. And so that means that if it was the fact that he was gone that had the inherent power to define what my future had to look like, I couldn't do anything about that. I would not have agency and I would not have opportunity. And therefore, I would not have hope. Right. But it's the fact that I can choose the perspective, the attention that I pay to it, and the way that I pay that attention to it. And I can choose what those things mean to me and what I get to do in response to those different choices. And that's what the trauma is going to turn out to be for me, the response. And so that means each of us have a great opportunity in front of us when we go through something hard. And it is, if you look at how your life is playing out in the post-trauma situation that you're in, and it's not helping you, your marriage isn't what it should be, you're choosing habits or numbing behaviors that are not producing flourishing in your life, if the choices, if the responses that you've made after that trauma are not helping you, remember the two principles we started this conversation with: the way your brain works and the way you can direct that neuroplasticity, you can begin to ponder these events from a different perspective. Your brain will immediately begin to lay down reinforcing structural changes to begin to try to automate, to move the automation from that maladaptive, harmful one to something that's more helpful to you. And if you just keep unplugging those wires and plugging new ones in, eventually you're going to change that trauma response to something that's more helpful to you. And that means you have skin in the game here. You've got opportunity. You've got agency. You have hope. It's incredibly empowering, Jim, that none of us are forced anatomically, structurally, neurochemically, or any other way. We're not forced to be how we have been or do what we have done if it's not helping us. We can change those things. It might require professional help. It might require a lot of repetition. It might require a tremendous amount of effort. But it is changeable, and it starts as soon as you change what you think about.
I like that. You were so wise. I'm just, you were so good at this. I really appreciate this.
Well, let me just say, because I don't want anybody listening to think, oh, that guy's a brain surgeon. He's got it all sorted out. Like, this is stuff I figured out, like crumbling over the death of my son, like weeping in his closet. The day I used to go down to his room, was downstairs. We had a house in Auburn where you came in on the ground floor and went down to the kids' bedrooms. And my son's bedroom was downstairs. And I would go down there every day and I would sit in his closet and I would smell his clothes. Could smell him. What he smelled like. And I went down there one day and I couldn't smell him anymore. The time had passed enough that the clothes had all faded. And it just broke me. Because something made me feel like he was really gone then, like I couldn't smell him anymore. He wasn't immediate to me anymore. And so when I say these things to you, I want you to hear that guy saying them to you.
Yeah.
This guy who's been studying this for 13 years, who's been around thousands of people that I just told their kid didn't make it or their husband has a fatal brain cancer. I've been around people in those moments when they've got to figure out how they're going to take that next step forward. I've been helping steward my wife and my family through it. And so this isn't some kind of inherent wisdom that I have that's not accessible to you. It's just, I've figured out how the thing works because I've been working it in my own life. I think just like you probably tell your people that you help steward through 12-step programs, like this is a process that you have to walk through to figure out that it works for you. And I can't make you believe that it's going to work for you. And so that's what I want to leave you with. Like this isn't my inherent brilliance. This is something that is operable for all of us.
No, I think you are. I can't encourage everyone who's listening now to pick up all of your books and read them. But you are a brilliant storyteller, and you take very complicated, challenging things and make them very simple, very personal, very easy to understand. And I read a lot of books. I read over 100 books a year, and yours is not just one that's a great book. You're very talented as far as a writer, as far as a storyteller, as far as making that connection. And we're so hungry for connection right now. You know, the modern world, we live in a moment where technology is, designed to reinforce existing beliefs through algorithms, echo chambers, social media that gives us more of what we already think. I guess the question, on that would be, does that make work harder today than it's ever been, in this area of brain? Are we becoming more stuck? Or are we becoming more aware?
I think both can be true, but I think for the most of us, we are engaging in a world that's a high-paced neurotransmitter trigger environment by design, right? The algorithms are driving us to seek quick reward, and that's turning our brains into structures that are wired to seek quick reward. And the path to an abundant, flourishing life, whether in business or finance or family or faith or any other genre, the path is not quick neurotransmitter release that leads to flourishing. It's do the work, change the wiring, reach a better ultimate neurotransmitter state because of better thinking that builds better structural brains that produces better relationships. And there's, and now we know there's even, it's not just you making changes for yourself. Like the way that your brain operates affects other people in multiple ways that are nonverbal. We have a mirror neuron system that affects the emotional state of people mm-hmm. around us without speaking to them. And that's what the Debbie Downer effect, right? Some guy comes into the office, he's in a super bad mood, and pretty soon that's contagious and everybody's in a bad mood and the guy hadn't even spoken to anybody yet, right? That's real. It's true. It's true. Real. Yeah. And it happens because of mirror neurons in your brain. We also know that the chemical environment, the electromagnetic environment of your heart, which is programmed by your brain, affects other people emotionally and physiologically up to like 15 meters around you. So even through walls. So if you're in a super bad mood, it affects people in another room that you don't even see or can't even interact with. And so that means that when we get it right in our own interior world, we become better leaders, not just through the things we say and do, but because we're affecting people's physiology around us in a way that galvanizes them or hurts them, brings them together or pushes them apart before we ever talk to them.
That is so good. I use several stories when I speak on, you know, the person who walks into the conference room and everyone's brain opens up. They're full of life. There are great ideas coming. There's a lot of psychological safety. There's joy. There's a lot of dopamine. Some of the greatest ideas come out of that room. And then a next guy can walk into the room and we close up. We don't want to say anything. You can feel the tension. Sometimes it's so thick you can cut it with a knife. And it just rubs off on the whole group. I think that's very true. It's very true. Now, you've held the human brain in your hands and you've done the deep work of rebuilding your own thinking from inside and out. If there's one thing most people fundamentally misunderstand about their thinking, one thing you wish they knew, what is it?
I think we've said it already in a number of different ways. I'm going to leave you with it mm-hmm. articulated exactly in a way that you have to accept or decline, but I want you to accept it. And that is that the way your brain is formed by the things that you repeatedly think about mm-hmm. and the perspective from which you think about them and the amount of attention that you pay to them. And so that means that anything in your life that isn't working the way you want it to will not change because somebody else changes or because your wife finally stops saying that thing to you or your kids finally stops triggering you or your employee finally starts showing up on time. It won't change for you until you change the way you think about those things. And then the corollary to that, the part B, is that this is not some sort of metaphorical kind of self-help imagery type of thing. This is actually how you turn your brain structurally into something different than it has been. So when you used to say, this is just how I am, you've never actually been just how you are more than a moment or two at a time because your brain constantly breaks and remakes connections. It just keeps making them in the same way until you change the thinking that drives those changes. So you have an inherent and immediately available opportunity and mechanism for by which you can change any aspect of your life that isn't serving you in a good way. And so if you're willing to do that thing that I call the patient to doctor switch, which is you say, I'm going to begin to direct this process as if I were delivering care to another person I was responsible for instead of just same old me, I'm going to direct that process and I'm going to take charge of it. And that I have hope that I will have a good outcome because that's how the system is designed. As soon as you can accept that idea that you're not a victim, you're not hopeless, you're not helpless, and you're not needing to wait for somebody else to come along and fix it for you. As soon as you're ready to say, I want to fix it myself, you can.
No, that is powerful. It has been just my honor to get to know you, to have this important conversation, and I really appreciate your honesty. I appreciate your vulnerability.
Thank you.
And more than anything, the work you're doing. This world needs this message more than anything. So, Lee, I just appreciate you. I appreciate you being here, and I want to thank you for coming on my podcast.
Thank you so much, Jim. It's good to see you, my friend.
Thank you.